So why don't we get started? Let me start off by asking my fellow panelists what this panel is about.
Well, it says monster creation, creating challenging counters.
Ah, yes.
One of those I'm better at than the other.
How to kill your player.
I'm really good at that.
Yeah, that part I can do.
I'm taking notes.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will provide more advice than the standard stun your players, because I don't believe in that.
Yeah, stun's cheap.
Stun's the cheap way out. So, why don't we introduce ourselves and tell a little bit about yourself and why you're sitting on the panel.
Okay. I guess I'll go first. I'm Dave, and I know 4 out of 6 people in the audience already, but I run criticalhits.com. I'm a co-founder of RPG Bloggers. My work may appear in an upcoming Wizards of the Coast product. I do a lot of stuff with blogs and Twitter for D&D.
I'm Eric Nowak. I'm usually a graphic designer for Black Dirge Publishing and Goodman Games. But lately, thanks to Matt, who brought me on board for writing the mini-campaign for
Literally.
SceneCon, I have been designing a lot of monsters and encounters, and it's been a good time. And I've been DMing D&D for like 22 years.
Wow, you're old.
I know.
I know this won't show up on the podcast if this is where you're putting it, but Eric's got the most impressive man beard in the entire convention, and I'm quite jealous because I trimmed mine. I'm Matt James. I'm a freelance writer and game designer. I've written for Wizards of the Coast, Open Design, Cobalt Quarterly, some guest stuff on Critical Hits, thanks to Dave here. I also run loremaster.org, where we just talk about all sorts of crazy stuff.
And make new powers.
And I make new powers every Wednesday. Only at wills, though. Hence the at will Wednesday. So today we're going to talk about how to challenge your players effectively. Maybe give some ideas. What do we want to talk about first? Let's start with the basics. Low heroic tier. What kind of concerns do you guys have about effectively challenging your players and keeping them? Challenging isn't just, you know, can we deal damage to them? Can we make them feel the wrath of the DM? Because obviously we know the DM can always do that. You can just point your finger and say, ha-ha.
Rocks fall,
you're dead. Ha-ha, how do you like that for challenging? No, it's also keeping your players involved in not just combat but skill challenges, keeping them motivated to want to sit there and listen to you instead of, you know, texting or playing, you know, messing around with the guy next to him or something. You never know. So what kind of questions do you guys have, or do you have any specific instances that you find are difficult to keep the attention of your players and keep them effectively challenged?
Well, why don't I tell you about my situation first, and
cool.
We can go from there. So I've been running since 4th edition came out, and it's a bunch of guys that I've known since forever, mostly, and my awesome girlfriend who's pointing to herself. I ended up, so they're halfway through Paragon tier now. We've gone from 1st to 15th level all the way through, and I've ended up with about 9 players to the extent that I've had to split them kind of into 2 groups. But the thing is that we're all kind of min-maxers. I mean, that's not to say that, you know, like the characters in my game don't have huge backstories and go through emotional things and I kill off their families. You know, all that happens. But when it gets into combat, like, they're really good. You know, I've got the Avenger Student of Kaifon, who criticals, like, every other role and does, like, hundreds of damage all the time and that kind of thing. The Cleric has taken pretty much every heal power she can, and it's also a dwarf, so she can heal herself pretty easily. You know, so on and so forth. Like, the Sword Mage is able to do all kinds of, like, I kill everything on the board every round, because I have burst every, you know, 20. So it's often a problem to challenge my players, right? And, but the thing is that not everyone is quite min-max to the same extent. I mean, there's, like, the Warlord, who isn't quite as much into the, you know, the whole min-maxing thing. So he often, like, if I were to just throw higher-level combats at them, you know, the defenses would be really high. You know, he misses a lot. It's just not fun for him, and that's not what I want, to be able to challenge my players. And I also don't like, well, I'm going to send this monster after this guy, or this guy is, like, you know, this is the anti-Avenger tank weapon or something. You know, I don't want to, like, single them out for having put together these characters that, you know, they like playing, but I do want to give them a challenge so they're not just steamrolling everything and at the same time kind of make up for that disparity. So that's why I've been thinking about this issue a lot.
One of the things I like to do, very underutilized, is terrain features or even terrain itself. You can do so much to challenge your players if, for instance, you know, if they're going to go fight this grand Arc Wizard, the Arc Wizard's not going to be like, well, I'm going to let these guys all come into a big, gigantic room of mine so that they can, you know, set up perfectly to destroy me. What am I going to do? I'm going to set them come down, let them come through this hallway that's pretty narrow, and right when they get to the middle of it, I'm going to start dropping fireballs and sleep spells. And, you know, there's only so much you can do when people get crowded. That's one example. I like using terrain features such as water. You know, a good swamp adventure is really awesome, especially if, you know, they're all on rafts and they're all trying to get through this swampy area. You know, they can't just run around or else they'll end up in the water and swampy area, and you might have creatures in there, you know, so on and so forth. So using terrain and kind of manipulating how movement modes work in 4th edition is a really good way of challenging players and getting them to think outside of the box to accomplish what you want, which is provoking these very unique ways. And I'm still surprised to this day when some of my players come up, you know, they get frustrated at first. You can see that look on their face like, oh, man, you really kind of screwed me here. But as soon as they start thinking about it, and then with the nature of 4th edition where it's a team game, they start coming up with these combinations of ways of overcoming these challenges. I still get surprised, and I'm like, ooh, damn, that's smart. And it also accomplishes another thing. It allows people to get creative with mundane equipment. I think, especially in, you know, like a living campaign, it's really easy to forget about your bedroll or this, that, and the other. But when you're in these unique situations, if the players are creative enough to come up with a way to use that shielded lantern or whatever, you know what I mean, then this gives you a way to kind of integrate that as well, and then it makes them feel like they're, you know, contributing in ways that, you know, doesn't necessarily have to come from a feat or a power. And it also makes them look at their skill list more and try to figure out weird ways that they can use those.
How many times have you had it come up where they needed a bedroll to beat the challenge?
Actually, well, not to beat the challenge, but someone came up with a couple ways, funny enough, with the bedroll. They were in a blizzard and they needed to come up with a way to camp for the night. So they decided instead of, you know, using their bedroll to, you know, to sleep in, they would use it to start building a lean-to, and that gave them a bonus towards the effects of the environment. And, you know, it was, you know, but no, it's never, oh, and I've actually had someone use a bedroll to, they couldn't get this guy to save versus ongoing fire damage. So they decided, like, DM, I want to use this blanket to try to put them out. And I was like, you know what, I'll give them a +4 to their saving throw. And luckily it worked. It would have been funny if it didn't, though. If it lit the roll on fire.
Right now I don't have a bedroll.
Instead of 5 ongoing, you're now 10 ongoing.
Yeah, you mentioned something about, like, a swamp adventure. We played in a My Realms adventure months ago where this guy ran this encounter that really stood out to me as it was a really fun, cool encounter.
Tom Black.
Yeah, it incorporated the environment of the swamp and movement as there were like 4 wagons and they're going through the swamp and they're kind of side by side and maybe moving a little faster than each other one might have been. But you could jump from wagon to wagon. And you're getting attacked by lizard men, and maybe your guy falls off. And if you get stuck in the swamp, then you're like slowed or moving at half speed. And then there's other monsters coming from behind, so you really didn't want to fall off, but you had to move from transport to transport to kind of to get at the lizard men who are attacking your guys.
It was awesome.
It was a really, really cool encounter, very well put together. I've been wanting to steal from that and use it in my own game. But yeah, movement is awesome. You know, having like vehicles and jumping from one thing to another is cool. And any kind of movement or terrain, lava, swamps.
And all of this, yeah, all of this goes beyond the. I think there's a tendency for any game master, especially when on the spot, you think, well, challenge the players. That immediately equals let me up their attacks, their damage, and stuff like that. Whereas this, you can leave the monsters alone. They're going to have plenty of advantages over the players just simply because you're using a unique environment.
Yeah, I'm not... I don't know. I think there's a lot of people who do really think that adding to the damage at least the monsters is a good idea, which I can see both ways.
Right.
I mean, you have the page 42 of the Dungeon Master's Guide that says, like, well, here's how much damage they should be doing. So you can always, like, bump it up to that next level. Like, the Monster Builder does this.
And DMG2's got...
DMG2.
But, for instance, for solos, they talk about instead of doing times 10 hit points, they say do times 4, but increase the damage by X amount and also give them, instead of a... Most solos have a double attack where they make their standard attack, but twice. DMG2 suggests that you even bump that to, like, say, a triple attack. I found going more on that is lower the hit points significantly, maybe cut them in half, but increase the damage by, like, 75%. So... the players are really getting beaten around. Because I found in 4th edition, you guys probably found this too, that healing surges don't get used as often. I mean, many times adventures will end and players still have 10 healing surges left, as an example, like a defender. Or even, here's a really great example that was poignant, was during the battle interactive at DDXP, one of my main characters is a level 16 dwarven fighter, you know, 18 surges and craziness. Through that double session battle interactive, even including the fact that during one of the skill challenges I donated 5 of my healing surges, I still had 3 surges left when everything was said and done. So, but that was probably the first time in a long time that I felt, whoa, I need to start managing my healing surges. Bottom line is what I'm getting at is by increasing the damage output, and lowering the hit points, because nothing's more boring than when you're fighting something for an hour and it's just doing kind of mediocre damage. It's like, okay, this is pointless. But if the thing's, you know, doing 30 points a hit, you know, the players are going to... They're not just going to run up and hug the thing and fight it and whatever. They're going to have to think smart tactically and technically. So, and I actually think that's one of the things I love about 4th edition is the team aspect. So you're going to force the players to kind of communicate with each other and figure out what they need to do to overcome the challenge.
I agree. Yeah, well, and going back to what you said about healing surges, I think that there are kind of multiple paradigms of how you structure your campaign even, or how adventures are structured, where with mine, I sort of view each adventure as like its own, it's like its own episode in a TV series. Mainly it's very episodic, like, and they tend to be very self-contained in an adventure because, you know, like, a lot of my players are busy guys. They don't necessarily want to keep track of, like, what magic items they've used from adventure to adventure. So I generally try to structure it so that they get an extended rest at the end of an adventure. And so, like, when you have it like that, I find a lot of times that there's somebody with, like, a boatload of surges left. But you can do some things to kind of mitigate that. It's actually one house rule I've been considering, and I'm not big on house rules, actually, oddly enough, but just not allowing extra healing powers during short rest, so they just have to use those
right.
surges and, you know, whatever. Like, the feats are still
interrupted.
Not fun. Yeah, well, I sort of hate that, too, though, right? Because, like, as a DM, I always have to be like, oh, you're resting for more than 5 minutes. Here's another random encounter, and I'm not going to be able to, like, get to the cool stuff I want you to get to, you know? It's like...
I've played around with a couple house rules where you can spend a healing surge to, say, give you, like, a +1 to an attack. Almost like kind of an LFR where they have the cards. You can use it to give a +1. Well, in this one, it's like, hey, you can use a healing surge. That's fine. But at the same time, you've got to be like, ooh, do I want to use my healing surge? Because I'm obviously using up my pool of available resources. Obviously, it would be an easier decision for a defender, unless that defender's getting really beat up. But...
You also notice a lot with skill challenge design that there's a lot of things that just eat at surges, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
I'm traveling across the desert. Oh, lose a healing surge. Lose another one. You failed another roll. Lose another one. So by the time they get to, like, the final boss area, they've already lost half their surges. And then there's, like, some... I've been running P2, and there's, like, a huge section in there that's, like, multiple skill challenges that are just drain you and drain you and drain you before this gigantic final combat.
But I kind of like that because it takes the players who... you know, only focus on combat, And it's like, okay, I wouldn't have been losing these surges if I didn't, you know, if I would have, you know, paid attention to my, you know, non-combat based
approach. If I'd been able to answer that riddle, I'd still be off.
Yeah. You've got the fighter who, he's got a million healing surges, right? He's got his heavy armor and his shield and stuff, and he's never getting hit in combat. Then you put him through a skill challenge where he's got to climb a mountain, and he's failing those athletics checks
because he's wearing
he's
his plate mail on his
shield.
Right?
So by the time the skill challenge is over, he's lost like 3 healing surges and then has to fight the dragon. You know, and you're at a serious loss. If you're playing in the SinCon mini campaign,
a lot of that happens.
You got to go through some serious skill challenges, and you will lose healing surges.
Yeah, I'm really happy with the way that turned out.
Before, and then you got to go into a big battle.
Yes, sir.
One thing I do when I run games is I do party initiative. And what that does is lets the party set up their move exactly how they want to. And then, but it also lets the monsters set up their moves exactly how they want to.
True.
So they get to, you know, set their phalanx or whatever if they're a bunch of hot goblins.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
So I could even the party all goes at once, and then the party goes, and then the monsters go.
And the one thing I do is whoever has the highest initiative bonus can always choose to go first if he wants to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he absolutely wants to do something before another player has a chance to do it.
Cool.
But, and
yeah.
Just take whatever their highest roll is, and if they beat or tie the monsters, they get to go first.
Fourth edition initiative is so important, and it's that's kind of going on a tangent, but yeah, initiative, and I kind of like that idea too.
Yeah, and even if you don't want to adapt that entirely, I could still see having a challenging encounter where the monsters are so ready for you, like, not only do they go first as soon as the door opens, like, they have a specific order worked out, like, all their tactics that you as the DM can write down ahead of time, yeah, and be like, oh, the dragon's going to use his breath, and then there's going to be a boulder, and then they're going to get crushed by a rock, and it's going to happen in this order because, you know, they saw the party coming or something.
I read a really good tip years ago about when you're using like super smart creatures like a, you know, the Yonti or a Beholder or Mind Flayer or something. Have them set up in the room like where they've got the best advantage against the players, almost like they knew what the players were going to do before they did it, because they're just smart enough to figure it out. And so you got to kind of, as a DM, metagame a little bit, get yourself into an advantageous position, but, you know, take advantage of the smarts of your creatures.
You could also combine that with a skill challenge and have it so that, like, if the PCs fail the skill challenge, they get to place themselves somehow in this room, you know, kind of how they want, but on the other hand, then the monsters get to place afterwards, like, if they fail the skill challenge, that the monsters have the most advantageous starting position, you know, the PCs are just sort of going into it blind, and vice versa, like, if the skill challenge succeeds, then the monsters are going to be there, and the players can put themselves into advantageous position.
Your beholder idea reminded me of another scenario that I didn't come up with, but I thought it was ingenious, where they had a couple beholders in the room, and of course the beholders can attack at range. They were using that to their advantage, but they were, as the players were moving towards them, they were retreating just enough, but they were retreating over terrain that would attack, and because they float, they obviously wouldn't be attacked. So they're kind of using their super intelligence combined with the terrain to kind of rake the players over this nastiness. And, you know, the first couple of rounds, the players are like, oh, we'll just go in and kick butt, like most DM groups. And then they're like, oh, wow, we're taking 15 points of damage just from the terrain alone every round, and these things are shooting us with laser beams. So, and that was more indicative of the beholder being like, well, geez, that barbarian there is going to, you know, kick me, you know, it's going to give me a cataract. Uh-huh. So, so they use their intelligence to take away the advantage, and it also kind of lets other players shine, like the ranged ranger or the wizard that was there. And but yeah, it was definitely challenging.
One of my favorite evil DM scenarios involving beholders is you have like a section, maybe like of elemental earth or something, just like this huge chunk of rock, right? And the beholders have used their disintegration rays to carve out like tunnels going in all sorts of crazy directions. And so like players, like unless they can fly, like have to climb up like at some parts and like move in one direction in some ways. But beholders can just sort of go wherever and like make themselves new openings. So they can come at the players from like literally any direction.
Yep.
And the players can't necessarily go and chase them. And so it creates this whole, and then they can like, you know, telekinesis ray, oh, you just fell down that whole thing that you just climbed up.
Yeah,
that's a great idea. So,
and it forces the players to reevaluate. Well, okay, we can't charge up these stairs because these guys have a major advantage. So what are we going to do to try to overcome this? And you know what? Unfortunately, especially in home games, sometimes you just got to leave and rethink it back at the tavern and be like, okay, well, these guys are doing this, so I got it. Let's get in a spell jammer and fly over them and crush them. That's a little overmuch. You had a question or a comment?
I did.
Oh, you.
You mentioned in the beginning the heroic tier and specifically issues with the heroic tier. And you said that now in mid-Paragon you're finding it a lot more difficult. I mean, one thing I saw was I didn't really have too much trouble keeping general combat challenge high in heroic until they got their Paragon abilities. And as soon as they got their Paragon abilities, you know, their damage shot up about 50%.
Yeah, it'd be even crazier.
I think there's another.
And that was immediately when I found it a lot more difficult to put a challenge on.
Yeah, and in my game, like, because I was running from the beginning and new stuff was coming out, I allowed pretty liberal retraining of, you know, whatever. And so when they had Paragon, there was a lot of, like, rebuilds and a couple new players joined. So I think that's also something else that scales it up in the player's favor. Like, if they can design their character from scratch to 11th level, it's a lot different than going up from first level based on whatever gear that they end up getting and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you end up with much more powerful characters if they're allowed to design their characters at this higher level. And so that caused an immediate escalation there, too. Like, I'm not sure if it, like, I think the fact that they're Paragon level, of course, has a lot to do with it, too. But
I think you
got to
be a lot more creative when you get into the Paragon and then, in turn, Epic.
I've noticed less with Epic, actually. I mean, yeah.
We had a lot of fun with that bloggers game that you were in, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Our main players are now 22. And
oh, nice.
I no longer, occasionally still do it, but I no longer have to up the damage a lot. The damage on Epic level creatures seems to be...
There's some new great monsters that have these auras that prevent, like, it's an aura 3, and it prevents use of healing surges while you're within the aura. I found those to be really, really awesome. And I've actually taken that ability and applied it to, like, say, a stationary... For instance, it's like a rune that's applied to a column in a room. So that way, if a player... Okay, so you got your really awesome... Like, I have this half-orc paladin that just gets up in people's faces... He can do that. That's fine. But the team has to make decisions. Like, if Dorne gets up there and does that, Dorne's not getting healed. But at the same time, you know, then they have to levy. Well, is it worth him getting up there and locking him down and attacking him? Or, you know, so I find that taking cool abilities from monsters and applying it to terrain features is kind of cool, too. As long as it doesn't get, as long as it makes sense to an extent, you can't just be like, a big rainbow appears, and nobody can use surges ever. And then, you complained. You take 20 points of complaint damage. So,
yeah, I'm a big fan of active terrain pieces, not just like kind of a static bonus or whatever for hanging out near it. Like stuff that both the monsters and the players use. And it sounds kind of counterintuitive to give something that the players can use to make it more challenging, but it actually does make it a more challenging encounter because it gives these sort of little, like, sub-goals, which is another thing I should go into, but, you know, like, well, I was running P2 recently, and, like, there's this big underground city, and there's a big bridge that goes into it, and a big pit in the bridge, and so I swapped some of the monsters for stuff that had forced movement. So, like, I was trying all the time to throw players off this bridge and take 10d10 damage and possibly break their legs and whatnot, and then be trapped underneath. At the same time, though, they were like, hey, wait a second, you know, they're trying to do that to us. Let's try to throw them off because, you know, they're like crazy spider things. Like, it's going to take them a while to climb back up from that at the very least. You know, so it created this interesting dynamic where they weren't necessarily going for, like, well, I'm going to use my most powerful power on this and just slog it out. They were actively trying to position themselves to take advantage of that terrain piece, which was another kind of challenge.
And that reminds me of one... Thank you for bringing that up, because for whatever reason, it sparked my memory. One thing that I love to do in home games, well, I can't do it all the time, or else the players always expect it, but one monster I had, it's got its set statistics for, and it, at first, it's really nasty. I'm talking, it could be a solo or an elite that just does copious amounts of damage and crazy abilities, but at the same time, there's a skill challenge going on, and say there's, say, 6 runes, like, basically like traps, essentially, that they have to deactivate. They don't have to, but as long as they remain active, this guy is nasty. And then for each one that they start to deactivate, he starts to lose power. So it kind of makes them, it's like, okay, we can go at this full force, but at the same time, he's going to be full force. Do we want to take away some of our resources to get someone to go over to that rune to try to deactivate it? Because there's still a chance they won't deactivate the rune. So it creates this dynamic where people start freaking out. And I love when players freak out in a good way. When they're... And everyone here probably knows, it's the player, because I do it too, when things, you know you're challenging your players when they stand up. They stand up at the table and they lean over it and they're like, oh man. They're not upset, they're just like, wow, this is nuts. And then they start delegating. And there's always the one guy who's like, okay, you need to go to this. When players start standing up, instead of sitting back like this with their iPhone or Droid and they're like, I'm going to use my at will. Yeah, it does that. Okay, you get, go ahead and spend a healing surge. No, I mean, they're actively, they're like, wow, man, we can't.
Yeah, how do I prevent from being stomped?
How do I prevent this?
Round?
And it does a couple things, too, because, you know, like my wife, she's not like me. She's not like a go in and, you know, balls to the walls, fight, da da da. She's more the person who likes the skill challenges and puzzles and stuff. So if you have a puzzle involved, and I think this would be a good time to mention Monument of the Ancients, Dragon 172, written by Matt James and Brian R. James.
Hell of an adventure.
No, but...
Soon to be converted for RPG.
Soon to be,
really?
Converted, yes.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes. Did you hear that? Soon to be, okay. No, but so you introduce these challenges while everything else is going on, and people are going to start pulling their hair out. But you know what? If they defeat the encounter, and in most cases they will, at the end they're like, dude, that was flipping sweet. You know what I mean? It's like, what? So... Then you run into the problem is you're going to have to find out ways to, you know, make it better next time or something like that. But, you know, it's something like that's great for the end of a story arc. You know, if you're getting to the end and you've got your big antagonist and they've been, you know, going after this guy, say, since level 1 and they're level 25 now or something, you know.
For the climax, just throw everything you got, yeah. You know, like, who cares? Just keep, like...
There was this one guy who ran for me and you, I believe, and he threw Grast... with two elites. And Grass is like a high... two Baylors.
I saw pictures of that.
Yeah, that guy was an SOB, awesome. Man. But you know what? We had a lot of fun. And at first, I think some of us were like... Because we knew out of game, metagame-wise, okay, that's a really high-level solo, and those are two really high-level elites. This is not making sense. But you know what? We figured it. We figured out what we needed to do, and in the end, it was really awesome. So
did you make it through?
We did. We kicked that DM's butt.
The Revenants in our party was at like -200 hit points.
Yeah,
like,
Revenants. That's a whole nother seminar, folks. Revenants and 4th edition. But so. Those are some ways. Do you guys have other ways to...
I have one more tip before I forget about it. Like, this is my tip that also covers, like, speeding up combat, making it more challenging. Like, I think this is so key, that you give your battles objectives. Like, it's not just you're going to walk into a room and kill everything and then move on. Like, you know, it can be something very simple, like you want to get to the other side of the room, but it can also be like there's somebody that needs to be protected. There's some information that we need to get. There's somebody we're here to assassinate. Like, in my game, there's actually, like, the emperor of the place they were in had been replaced by a Rakshasa, and they had done some skill checks that were like, okay, to kill the Rakshasa, the killing blow needs to come from the Blessed Crossbow Bolt. And so they're like, well, he's got all these angel bodyguards and stuff we have to cut through, and we've got to fight him. You know, he's not going to go down without a fight, but at the same time, we have to get him into, like, the killing position. And that created a really challenging fight. It was also on top of a big tower, so, like, they're also getting thrown off the tower and stuff. But they also couldn't do that to the bad guy because, you know, they couldn't risk him dropping, dying, and then being reincarnated somewhere. Like, they need to do the specific thing. So, like, adding some kind of objectives to as many fights as you can, I think, will always help. You know, and plus, it gives you these outs where if... You know, they, like, something goes wrong in the combat, or, like, you know, the PCs accomplish their objective and the bad guys are like, whoa, okay, we surrender, or, you know, like, if the objective is to take out the big boss and then all the little guys surrender after that, it cuts down on the fight time, and still, you know, they're going to fight up until then. It just makes it gives it a more interesting texture all the way through.
And one really cool thing about 4th edition is all the different terrain and traps and monsters and hazards and things that you can have. Like, you should almost never have an encounter that's just, here's a 20 by 20 room, there's two barrels and spider webs, you know, and four monsters inside. You know, never. You should always have a falling bridge and, you know, a lava waterfall and all kinds of crazy things going on most of the time. I mean, every once in a while you got to throw in a pretty mundane encounter, but...
And you got to do that because then the players are going to think, this is so mundane, there's got to be something in here. I will waste an entire turn. Standard action, I'll check this barrel. You find nothing.
There's so much you can do to make it fantastic. You know, have earth motes crashing into each other 50 feet above a river, you know, and you're fighting on griffins. I don't know.
And honestly, that's... I think a lot of people get that impression from, like, a lot of the official, like, modules and stuff and some of the stuff published, not Monument of the Ancients, of course, but other Dungeon Magazine things where they have, like, just encounters that you're like, why is this in here? What purpose does it serve? And it's just kind of a boring room
spice
on the way
up
to something else. Yeah, spice them up or take them out, you know? Like,
absolutely.
Always feel free to slice away at those.
I also like inverting combats and skill challenges. And follow me for a second. A meta combat where it's actually a combat encounter, but it's actually run more like a skill challenge. And I wish I brought a diagram or something. But line up all your players. So you got five of them. And then this is an example. And say they have to protect the Baron of whatever. So you have them all on a grid map, and you have one. You have the guy they're protecting, one behind. Okay, you're understanding meta combat. This is just a representation of the combat. It's not actually, I'm one square ahead of his. Then you have your main bad guy. Then you go down the line in initiative order, and you have one going, okay, what are you going to do? Are you going to step up to attack this guy, or are you going to defend this person? And it's really ingenious. So if the person's, you know, if they don't attack this guy, the whole point is you don't want this person to die. So this person's like, well, I'm a fighter, so I'm going to step up to attack. And you go down the line. And if a person stays behind, they use a skill check to figure something out or progress the combat, so to speak. At the end of the day, what you're doing is you've basically taken a tactical combat encounter and turned it into a meta combat where it's more like a skill challenge. So you still allow fighters to be their fighters and people who like to fight to be fight, but the people who want to protect the person have to use the story elements to figure out the skill to protect and do whatnot. The same can happen where you can take a skill challenge and actually have it be a combat, where they have to defeat certain enemies in a certain order. They have to... Are you following what I'm saying? Where you're kind of inverting what traditionally is what people go... Like, I have friends, and I'm sure we all have the... Like, no offense, your brother. And if you're like, well, you know, if they get a whiff that it's a skill challenge, they literally, like... You literally push away from the table, and they're like, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. This is ways to kind of mix it up where it's, you know, it's like, well... You're important in this skill challenge, believe it or not. It's not a matter of, you know, traditional combat. So I think the point that I'm trying to get across is just think outside the box and find different ways to bring people in.
Yeah, and good thing mentioning the skill challenges. Make those dynamic. You know, not just, okay, I make a DC 20 athletics check. You know, really when you're designing the skill challenges, go into specifics about... It's not just a random athletics check. You know, maybe you're going through an obstacle course, or you know, you got to get over a wall or whatever. And you know, really describe the action, what's going on, and make the players, you know, really engage them, so that they feel like they're doing something rather than just making an insight check. And that'll keep the more combat-oriented guys involved, so that the skill challenge feels more like a combat almost. They're doing stuff.
I think feedback in skill challenges is extremely important. You can't just be like, that was success, next. Like, mm-hmm. You got to say, like, here was the result of your action, and even try to make things that change it for the next people. You know, like, well, he's, you know, that you failed. Like, you don't even have to say you failed. Like, you know, you tried diplomacy, but he's really offended now. Like, choose your next action very carefully. You know, have it sort of evolve and change as it goes, you know, and give each person, like, sort of, you know, continue the narrative with each skill check.
And I would stay away from the words fail or succeed. Don't even say that. Like he was saying, instead, you know, it's like, okay, you have to jump over this ravine. Okay, I'm going to make an athletics check. No. I want you to tell me what you're doing. You don't have to tell me out of game what you're going to be rolling based off your character sheet. And if they do it, don't go, okay, you succeed. Nope, strike, succeed, and fail. Just say, okay, you get a running start. You begin to lose your footing, but at the last moment, you're able to spring forth in this great bout of strength as you leap across. And you'll find that even the most non-story-based players will really start to get into it, because who doesn't like being Rambo and G.I. Joe or whatever? You know what I mean? They'll start to get into it, and what you're doing subliminally is you're provoking them to start thinking outside of the box, and you'll find they'll start describing their powers slowly over time instead of saying, I use Tide of Iron, I push them one square. No, it's like, okay, I shield bash him upside his face, and I push him one, woo, and then high-five the guy next to him. But really, if you think about it, that's a lot cooler the way they described it than, okay, I rolled a 19, and I did this. So, yeah, I thought that was a good point.
One of the biggest challenges I haven't played any Epic in 4th edition, I know 3.5 earlier. The players have so many high-power abilities, it's throwing a challenge at them that if you overstep, though, it's like you start to get a few rounds and you realize, oh, this is going to totally wipe them out. I've made something too powerful. Or the other way that, okay, they've found some exploit I didn't think about. They're going to totally... So try to find something dynamic in there that doesn't look like you're cheating. Like I like your sense about objectives. If there's something objective, because they don't know what the end result of the objective is going to be. If
right.
they succeed in pushing the button... You can decide
what's going to happen.
They could completely demolish that encounter, but that might not have been the objective. So they're like, yeah, wow, we took that guy out in 2 rounds. And it's like, okay, that's kind of out of game, but did you accomplish the objective? Maybe you weren't supposed... Well, maybe the objective wasn't kicking that guy's butt so fast. Maybe you needed a piece of it. You know, like the guy had a piece of information he was willing to give up, but now you're stuck in this, you know, oubliette of a magical cube room, and you can't get out because you killed the only guy who knows how to get you out.
Yeah, that's true, but not only that, I was saying, like, for instance, if he's, you know, wiped, you know, 2 rounds in, all of a sudden the healer and, you know, Striker's dead, and there's 3 guys left, and you don't think they're going to make it, you know, and, but one of them accomplishes some, you know, pushing of a button or doing some combination. Originally you had planned the monster would, you know, he'd get slowed or something. Okay, they need more help than that. Instead,
yeah.
It's going to be
even
more help.
Yep. Yeah, that's building in those outs that I was talking about. Yeah, like, because when they accomplish those objectives, you can always, as a DM, sort of adjust and say, well, I need to scale back this combat, and this is a good trigger.
Right.
That happened to me a couple of weeks ago. I was running the H3 adventure, the Pyramid of Shadows. And there's this, you're fighting one of the boss guys, and at some point, there's it's this necromancer. And I hope I'm not spoiling anything. I'm not going to be too
bastard.
Specific. But basically all the furniture in the room and everything in the room is made out of these bones. And there's a lot of finger bones. And anytime you get close to any of the furniture or the pillars in the room or whatever, the finger bones get out and grab you. And this was written before DMG2 came out. So all of the DCs to escape and things like that were just through the roof high. And my players were dying. You know, they were just being held down, couldn't move, couldn't get anywhere. So I was like, you know, once they bloody the necromancer, then the bone things are going to back off, and they're going to be like -2 to hit. They're going to start doing half damage, and that ended up working. Like, my players were going to die. They were easily not going to live through this encounter. But finally, they managed to bloody that dude, and after that, just that -2 to hit. The bones stopped getting them, and it stopped doing so much damage. They still used almost all of their healing surges and barely made it out alive, but it was a really fun, challenging encounter. They felt like they accomplished something, and I felt like I gave them a really good challenge, but not. I didn't want a TPK, you know, that kills my storyline.
And again, the trigger could have easily gone the other way. If it looked like it was too easy for them, they could have, you bloody, fuddling frenzies, they get more power.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I wanted to bring up was the, I think there's a mentality that when a group of players goes into encounter, it's not a matter of winning and losing. It's more of, this encounter can be beaten. It's just a matter of how. I think you should set up, especially in home campaign, set it up so that they have to make intelligent decisions at a game. As frustrating as it's going to be, it's like, should I stick around and fight this thing? I mean, is this going to be a Pyrrhic victory? I mean, we might win, but how much are we going to give up winning this? So have them constantly making these kind of, you know, internal checks or asking other players, like, okay, we could win this. What I'm getting at is maybe they shouldn't win every single encounter. Maybe they're not meant to win every single encounter. Maybe there's an encounter for story purposes where it's like, we got to run away from this, because if we don't, we're dead and we're the heroes, and if we don't live, then what we're trying to accomplish is all for naught. So, but in the end, they might go back and encounter these guys or whatever and be the victors, because at the end of the day, you want to present a really heroic feeling, provoke a heroic feeling in your players. And if not, man, don't ever invite me to be in your game. Because we play these games. We play Dungeons & Dragons not because, you know, we're weird. Okay, we're weird. But, no, we want to live these moments where we do really cool things and we're admired by our peers for being really smart in certain circumstances. Or maybe we DM because we like telling stories that provoke those feelings. So, point being, they shouldn't have the mentality that when they go into an encounter, it's not that they're not going to be able to beat it. That they're just, okay, well, what do we need to do to beat this? It shouldn't be that. There should be some times where they're like, maybe we shouldn't be here, or maybe we shouldn't fight them in this area. Maybe we should retreat. You know, if, like the beholders. Someone might be intelligent enough to be like, well, if the beholders are fighting here, why don't we just retreat back? I mean, they're not going to hurt the townsfolk fighting, you know, being right here. They're going to have to leave here at some point. So you start adding this third dimension to your story that I think a lot of people kind of forget about.
Yeah, I think an important thing is that the encounter guidelines, like, they are just guidelines, for one, and that it's there to be able to gauge, you know, how powerful a particular encounter is going to be against your party. Not necessarily like you always have to throw that at your party. It's just a tool like any other.
And you really throw off the, you know, God love them, the guys who memorize every word in, like, the Dungeon Master Guide, and they know how every encounter is supposed to be built. You're throwing them the massive curveball because, like he said, those are guidelines. And you prevent, so to speak, someone from ruining the fun for everyone else by if they're just going to sit there and go, well, technically, you're only supposed to have this many, because you're only supposed to be 10,000 XP in this encounter. And you know what I mean? So you got to, you know, keep the rules. And that brings up a whole other point. That's actually one thing I really love about 4th edition is that some people are like, there's not enough fluff. It's only, you know, these base core. They give the foundation. And yeah, it's for some people I could see how it could be frustrating. It's a little more work. But you just take that core foundation and you make whatever you want. Instead of there being a paragraph for a statistical rule about anything that you do. And hey, and let me say, I loved 2nd edition when I first started playing Dungeons & Dragons. I loved it for what it was. I love 3rd edition, 3.5. I don't miss any of those moments. And I love 4th edition. I've loved every edition moving up. So it's not an edition war thing.
You can say that for our seminar tomorrow about the edition war.
Oh, that's right. But anyways, point being, don't be afraid. That's one way to challenge your players, too, is if you got the analytical thinking guy that thinks he's got everything hammered down, well, life doesn't work that way, and neither does my game. So you got that's another way to challenge them.
Sometimes you get a player, like you were talking about the retreat factor. You know, maybe you got to let this one go. Sometimes you've got a player who just thinks that is cowardly and never wants to do that. And sometimes that player's got to die.
Yeah.
And the rest of them can escape.
And luckily in this fantasy world, there are ways of bringing that friend back. And then the party will be like, you idiot, we had to spend 5,000 gold to get your butt back. Have you learned, you know? And hopefully they're role-playing the character, and it's not just the player being like that. But if the character's doing it, maybe the character will learn, you know, maybe my God's purpose for me is not to run in and die and cause my party, you know, massive
mess. I've gotten so much of that where it's like, well, my paladin wouldn't retreat. Like,
well, then
your paladin's going to die, and he's not going to do anybody any good, dummy.
Make the decision. Yes.
The thing I'm having a hard time with the idea of having, you know, bringing out creatures that are way above whatever the party's level is that when I look at how my party is able to handle so much of them throwing at them, that even if I were to throw, they're level 22 now, and if I threw Orcus on the table, they'd probably stand toe to toe with it for about 10 or 12 rounds, and they go, you know, we're missing all the time. And when we hit, it doesn't look like we're doing any real damage to them, but we're okay. You know, we've got
well, then what I would do, considering Orcus is a god,
yeah.
And I don't know if you've read up a lot on Orcus's history, is it the actual lore on Orcus, but I would just have Orcus get frustrated in game, like get him pissed off, like you guys are SOBs. Screw that, Gate. Let me bring in my generals to help me out, you SOBs. And then the players are going to they're going to get real, you know, oh, maybe we shouldn't piss off a god. So, yeah, I mean, for that specific instance, when they're dealing with a god, I can totally see someone like Orcus just getting irate and just being like, okay, you SOBs, I'm going to invoke my divine power to unleash hell on you. And, you know, I guarantee, you're the DM. The Abyss, I'm sorry. No, well, there are nine hells.
Orcus is a demon.
I know he's a demon, I'm sorry. But anyways, so...
I also would say that the technique we're talking about throwing something that they can't beat at the party, by the time it gets to epic, like, I think it's totally understandable to be like, right, we're awesome and can take on gods, bring Orcus on. Like, I think that's more reasonable, and you wouldn't necessarily use that unless you have some other plans for how that's going to go.
And it might be cool for them in a way to kill Orcus, because then you open up a complete, like a player, like think about it, the Holy Paladin's like, oh, damn, we just took out Orcus. Well, now,
who else can we kill?
The Abyss doesn't have, there's a power vacuum in the Abyss now. You've just created a political crap storm. So now you just open, yeah, they feel great, they just killed a god, but it's like, man, for you, that's a gem. You guys just created a massive political... The worlds themselves are in turmoil because you kill grass, you know, or whoever.
I know what I wouldn't do is I wouldn't throw Orcus at a party at the start of an adventure to see how it goes.
10 battles first.
Yeah, or wait for it for the end so you can be like, okay, what the heck am I going to do now based on the results of how the battle goes, you know, like as a DM. Make sure that you're giving yourself enough time to prepare about potential consequences one way or the other, you know.
And depending on the story, I would see throwing Orcus level 1. And I'll tell you why. Because you have Orcus come out, and the players, they're going to laugh at you. They're going to be like, whatever, dude, this isn't Orcus. This is some aspect of Orcus that's level 5. And it's like, no. Boom! Kills all the players. Players wake up. Follow me for a second. They wake up in the temple of this whatever, and it's now the beginning of their story. Now they have a purpose. Because Orcus kicked their butt, and they just got resurrected by priests of whoever. And it's like, now you must go through the world and help make sure this doesn't happen again. So now, they got this great adventure. And when they finally fight them when they're epic level, they're like, you kicked my butt when I had a +1 to attack instead of a, now I got +30. Wah! So, yeah.
That's good. Yeah, it makes them feel great about
it. It makes them feel awesome.
There at the end.
Because they got embarrassed in first. So, and it doesn't have to be at level 1. You know, leadership is the process of invoking purpose, direction, and motivation. And I use that principle with creating storylines and adventures. They have to have a purpose. You provide them direction and obviously motivation. Now, that motivation might be revenge because I was embarrassed by Orcus when he kicked my butt when I was level 1. Or it could be anything. And that's where you start to rely on characters' histories and stuff. So, Orcus, level 1, do it. I'm all for it.
Yeah, and I recommend that the end game of any campaign should be fighting and killing a god.
Yeah, absolutely. Or multiple ones.
Elder Red Dragon with the gigantic miniature I'm also a fan of.
Yes.
I did that recently. The Colossal Red Dragon. And I did, you know, if you don't mind, I'll talk about that encounter real quick.
Yes,
please do. I'd like to know more about it.
Well, is it in regards to challenging your play? Well, it is. All I had them do is they fought this. They knew they had to go after this power, so they ran. They came across a dragonborn raiding party that was hunting this dragon, the same dragon they wanted to hunt. So they started fighting. They fought this nasty elite. Well, while they're fighting it, they accidentally spawned what was supposed to be the second encounter, which was a black dragon. And I used the black dragon gargantuan mini, came out, and they're like, "Oh crap!" So all of a sudden, their bad guys are now allies as they're fighting this. And the wizard did something silly, which spawned the third one, which was the colossal red dragon coming. So it was the fish eats the bigger fish eats the bigger fish. But it was really fun for them, because then all of a sudden, now they've got a black dragon ally, because the colossal red dragon's fighting the black dragon, and then you got the dragonborn fighting. So anyways, you want to talk about challenging. Wow,
yeah.
That's challenging for a DM, too.
But you know, like, the whole thing about triggering the next room, or however you want to put it, also will probably challenge your players, because now you have like a double size encounter that's coming at them. I mean, like, it's kind of a pain in the ass to run like a three way encounter, but at the same time, like,
it is challenging.
If they happen to like spill into the next room where there's a bunch of other bad guys who didn't happen to hear the commotion, they're like, hey, wait a minute, our allies are fighting, and you suddenly, like, your PCs are surrounded. That will be a challenging encounter.
Yeah, in this case, the wizard dropped a fireball, which alerted the Black Dragon. Black Dragon comes out, and he's all doing craziness. Meanwhile, Colossal Red Dragon's like, whoa, whoa, why is there a Black Dragon in my lair? I won't get into the whole story, but yeah, so that's one way to provoke it. So if a player wants to use the crazy, you know, whatever, like, if they're being stealthy and the barbarian uses Howling Strike, I mean, it's like, how? No, man, you... So it makes them also, yeah, so that challenges them too, because it's like, well, geez, I'm optimized for my Howling Strike, but dude, if I do this, I'm going to wake up, you know, whatever. So, yeah.
I've had that happen too, where, like, you know, the one bad guy is escaping, and the assassin's like, well, I'm going after her, and, you know, like, and she goes to the next room, and, like, there's all these other bad guys in the next room, and the other guys are still fighting what was in the last room, and, you know, all of a sudden it's like, well, do we want to rescue our idiot assassin, you know?
Exactly, it's like, well, okay, someone prepped the resurrection ritual.
Sorry, isolated PC.
and smart bad guys do have plans when they retreat. They don't just go, I'm going to run away until I run away. They might have an entire brigade of something waiting for them, and I would argue most of these bad guys do. So, like, okay, going back to Grast or even Orcus, if they're kicking his butt, have him retreat back into the abyss, and the player's like, yeah! And then they get in there, and it's like, oh, jeez. Not to mention the effects of the abyss, if you've read Manual of the Planes, and you might even attach more stuff that maybe Grast's, or I'm sorry, Orgus's attacks are even more potent when they're... You know, when his home plane. So that's another way to challenge him. And the I guarantee you, the players are gonna. They might go in there and they're like, oh, okay, we might want to, you know, leave and rethink of this. And yeah.
So do we have any more questions or like?
Did you guys get some good ideas? I hope.
I keep.
No, please.
Go for it.
No,
come on.
So I'll hit my current number one technical problem, which are resistances.
Oh, I got good ways for this.
Yeah, I can only come up with so many ways to deal with resistances. That I either have creatures that, you know, the resistances are now hitting like, what, 10? Often 10, sometimes as high as 15. Mm-hmm. And if I have a creature, particularly with necrotic resistance, if I have creatures that are almost entirely based on those powers, mm-hmm. they go from being really threatening to almost nothing. And the only, you know, there's a few ways around it, but all of them are either the monster's really not that effective, or I'm screwing the player. And I haven't found a good balance of, you know, I can give a guy cold and necrotic, and now he bypasses resistances on anybody except those who have both, which screws the player. Or, and that's okay, because then I'm only screwing three of the, you know, six. But, you know, or I can bump up the damage, in which case they better have the resistances, or else they're going to be taking a whole lot.
Yeah,
so I can't find a real good way to deal with resistance, in particular that high Paragon and Epic tier.
Resistances are very tricky, and it's a delicate balance because, like, if a wizard took mass resistance as their daily utility spell, you don't want to kind of screw the guy because he was trying to be smart and think ahead. Same with people who make equipment choices. There are monsters out there, and you can use them for terrain effects, like we were talking about earlier, that suppress resistances. And there's no reason not to... Like, if they run into a random creature that has ongoing whatever... And it's a stupid creature. Okay, that's cool. But if it's a creature that knows... If the players have the ability to get it, chances are an intelligent creature is going to know that players are going to have... Like, that people that might engage him. You know, even at first, maybe for the first couple rounds, their tactic works. But the guy's going to adapt and be like, ah, in that case, maybe I'll summon these two guys.
The reverse of vulnerability. You
know, yeah, there are some creatures.
Penetration ability that they have to figure out what the resistances are, but then they know...
I played in a game designer game at Gen Con where the creature was I forget. Anyways, Abolithic. So there were aquatic far realm type creatures. Got frustrated that the group had mass resistance and they had, you know, their whatever armors that gave mass extra resistances. So he pressed a button and the whole room instantly in one round filled up with water. There was no way to get out, and he basically drowned all the players.